Daniel 3:1-30. And we're following the progress of King, or rather the regress of King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he'd set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and people of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you've set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual, and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace was so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire? They replied, certainly, Your Majesty. He said, look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. The satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angels and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble. For no other god can save in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is the word of the Lord.
This is our third week looking at the book of Daniel. And it's a book that describes events that happened around 600 years before Jesus. As God's people, the Jews, and in particular several individuals whom we follow in the book, face the challenge of living faithfully to their identity and faithful to their beliefs in exile. And as I said last week, for that reason, it's always had a real resonance for Christian people, that sense of living in a surrounding culture which is slightly alien and unsympathetic to your deepest convictions and beliefs. And in Daniel chapter 1, which we saw 2 weeks ago, we were looking at Daniel's decision to set limits on where he would give in to the surrounding culture and where he wouldn't. In his case, he chose the issue of receiving food from a certain source. And then last week, we looked at the dream that the king had concerning a great statue that was destroyed and replaced by an immense mountain. And the interpretation of the dream was seen to be that all these worldly kingdoms will pass away and be replaced by God's everlasting kingdom. And these two ideas are related, of course. It's the person who strongly believes and understands the temporariness of current structures and the permanence of God's coming kingdom who is able to set limits and say, I won't give in on this issue. And that's what we see in Daniel chapter 3 that we've just heard read for us. It begins with the king, possibly the most powerful man on earth in his time and place, erecting an immense image. And we're given the dimensions. It's almost 30 metres tall and just under 3 metres wide. Now, beyond that, it's not described. Its proportions show that it's not the statue of a person. It's too tall and too narrow. It's fundamentally a huge column of some sort. But more important than its appearance is its purpose, the function that it serves. Nebuchadnezzar ruled an empire which had gobbled up surrounding nations. And so he presided over a huge number of different national and ethnic groups, diverse religions and languages and cultures. And he faced the challenge that all imperial leaders have faced before and since, of trying to unify his empire. Empires like this always have forces tearing them apart. And he's trying to give them a common allegiance. And the great column was his solution. So he says, peoples and nations of every language, he's speaking to his own subjects, peoples and nations of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. It's interesting, we're not given a great deal of detail, but there's no suggestion here that he's trying to abolish any local religions or suppress them. In a sense, you can go on worshipping your own gods as long as you also worship this image. We're all going to agree to worship this god alongside whatever else you want to do. This is going to be the basis of imperial cohesiveness, and so it is not optional. Verse 6, whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. And unsurprisingly, verse 7 tells us that levels of compliance were very high. Until we hear about these three Jewish men. These are exiles, and they've risen to become senior public officials in the province. They are not complying. And they're reported, and they're brought before the king, and as far as we can tell, the king bears them no personal malice. He's not looking for a pretext to get rid of them. In fact, he gives them another opportunity to do the right thing. Verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods? Worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace." And as I reflect on these events, I detect a very contemporary flavour to this. Let me explain. Nebuchadnezzar is effectively imposing a religious ideology across his empire and upon these men. And the religious ideology he's imposing is what? Well, basically, it's religious pluralism. The religion of this image, this column, is barely a religion at all, to be honest. There's no mention of a temple or priests or rituals or sacrifices or scriptures. But it has a powerful symbolic significance. By agreeing to worship the statue, they were surrendering all right to claim that their religion alone was true. After all, they were willing to worship the statue that everybody else was worshipping. To worship the statue was to accept relativist pluralism. You can still practice your own religion, but religion has become a private affair. You've lost the ability to say others are wrong because you too have worshipped the statue. And I think it's a pretty close version of the ideology which is the background to a 21st century Australian culture. We look at it in Daniel chapter 3, it's all very colourful, you've got this king and it looks bigoted, it looks coercive, forcing everybody to bow down and worship and whatnot. In 21st century Australia, it just feels like common sense. And like Nebuchadnezzar, the direction that this ideology takes is increasingly coercive. People who hold out seem to be unreasonable. He says, if you are willing to bow down, very good. Now, why wouldn't you? And so in our society, you can still practice your religion, you can still practice your Christian faith, but you must also worship the more general image. That is to say, you can't be Christian in a way that its truth is somehow seen as implying that other things are untrue. And you see the coercive tendency of this, I think, as I read culture, in the trajectory of some of our laws. Laws that, in a sense, come from a good impulse. Laws around freedom of speech and laws around the protection of individuals from discrimination. And this isn't just kind of wafty speech. You think even the last, say, 9 months or 6 months or less, there have been some really high-profile cases of this. you think of the decision that was taken to deregister the Evangelical Union at Sin University, 20 minutes away. The Evangelical Union had a rule where the members of its senior committee were required to sign a statement affirming that Jesus Christ is Lord and God. The university decided to deregister them because they were digging their heels in on this requirement. That decision was taken and later overturned. There was a public outcry and so forth. But just a fascinating thing is to say, well, of course you can have your own religion, but also don't be unreasonable. You know, if you're willing, when the music plays, you have to be willing to bow down. Or the anti-discrimination complaint that was made against the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Hobart. It produced a pamphlet that was distributed in Roman Catholic schools down there, summarising Roman Catholic teaching on marriage. The complaint was later withdrawn, but in the meantime, the commissioner made a preliminary finding that he might have a case to answer. Now, I'm not an alarmist. This is just our culture with its ebbs and flows, but it's all very enthralling, don't you think? And it's important to discern, I suppose, that these issues aren't a divide between religious nutters on one hand and neutral, right-thinking people on the other, which is how they're sometimes framed. It's why when we see them in Daniel chapter 3, it's so clear. We think, no, this is it's a clash of religious ideologies. Well, how should Christians conduct ourselves in that sort of space? Well, Daniel 3, again, gives us a bit of a lead in this. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. I find these are my favourite verses in all of Daniel. They know what every Christian person needs to know. They understand that faithfulness to God is not a deal that we strike with God in exchange for him making our lives better. They understand that in exile, faithfulness to God will ordinarily make your life harder. That's kind of what it means to be in exile. In exile, faithfulness to God will ordinarily make your life harder. Such an important expectation to have clear in our minds. And they recognize that and they understand it. Although we might say, well, what is the point then? What is faithfulness to God all about if it's just a way of making your life harder to no good purpose? So far, we're only up to chapter 3 of the book. Faithfulness to God has seen them reduced to vegetarianism and plotted against by their peers, and now at the point of execution. What exactly is it that they're trusting in? And, of course, the answer was a central idea that we looked at last week. They aren't interested in how God is going to fit into their life story. That's not their primary preoccupation. They don't see God as there to come into their life to get them out of a jam or to make things flow more easily or to help them prosper. What they're interested in is seeing how their little lives fit into God's great story. That's the mind-blowing thought for them, that their lives have a place in God's story, the story that was so graphically represented in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the stone that destroys all kingdoms and becomes this immense and everlasting and universal mountain. They align themselves with that God and with that vision. No matter what becomes of them, that's what they're living for. So it has always been for God's people, by the way. This is not a new idea. And so they say, the God we serve is able to deliver us and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, isn't that wonderful? Even if he does not, "We want you to know, Your Majesty, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." And so even Jesus himself said, "Father, if you are willing, let this cup pass from me, but even if it does not, not my will, but your will be done." And I wonder whether you feel that. If you're a Christian person, you resonate with that. You think, yes, that's right. God has bigger and more wonderful plans for his glory than even involve my own personal ease, that involve the satisfying of my own longings, real as they are. There's something more real and more wonderful. I was chatting with a friend earlier this week. He's not a Christian guy, but a very thoughtful and engaged sort of person. And he was saying how disappointing it is to live in our day and age when there's nothing big to live for beyond yourself. He feels like culture has lost something. He's saying, "Oh, you know, go back 100 years and people were living for king and country. There was this thing. But nowadays, yeah, we're just on about being successful and kind of getting on." And, you know, he knows I'm a Christian, and he kind of envied me that. He said, "Of course, you've got your beliefs, something big to live for beyond yourself." What he says is true, of course. But it's not as though being Christian just gives you an exciting set of ideas to act as a great compass in your life. That thing that we live for beyond ourselves involves, in Jesus' words, taking up your cross. It involves being able to say, "God is able to answer my prayers for health, for a happy marriage, for successful children, for a comfortable retirement. But even if he does not, I will live for him." It gives you something big to live for, but it involves being able to say, "God is able to reverse my diagnosis, or make my husband come back, or resolve the bullying situation at work. But even if he does not, I will live for him. I am part of his story. And I will not bow to some other story." Nothing could be more serious than this. And Christians have always known this. God's people have always known this. Let me read you an account. In 1885, the Muslim king Mwanga of Uganda ordered the arrest of three Christian page boys in an effort to stamp out Christianity, which had been brought to the country by missionaries 8 years earlier. The eldest of the three boys was 15, the youngest 11. Despite threats of being burned at the stake, they maintained their trust in Jesus, though people were weeping and their own parents were pleading with them. I wonder how you feel about that. At the place of execution, they sent a message to the king. "Tell his majesty that he has put our bodies in the fire, but we won't be long in the fire. Soon we shall be with Jesus, which is much better. But ask him to repent and change his mind, or he will land in a place of eternal fire and desolation." Those lads believed that even if he does not, that their stories were part of God's story. And what happens next in Daniel chapter 3 is very dramatic. We hear about the lethal heat of the furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar takes some kind of gruesome vantage point. We can see what's going on in the flames. And then we hear about the miraculous survival. The three men are saved. Saved, but how? "The three men, firmly tied," verse 23, "fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, 'Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?' They replied, 'Certainly, Your Majesty.' He said, 'Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. What's going on here? I mean, God has saved them, of course, but it's very mysterious, isn't it? If God had determined to save them, if I could put it like this, if God had determined to save them, he could have done so a thousand ways. Nebuchadnezzar could have fallen dead before the sentence was pronounced, or the furnace could have refused to light or whatever. But what in fact happened? They were saved not by the punishment not being carried out. No. The full punishment is performed, but someone else, someone from God, joins them in the punishment in such a way that they are shielded from its consequences. See that? Who's the fourth figure? We're not told. Nebuchadnezzar has a couple of guesses. He says in verse 25, the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Who knows what he was perceiving, what he was responding to there. Or in verse 28, he declares that God sent his angel, rescued the men. But this much is clear. They're saved because in whatever sense, God endures the judgment with them. And very soberingly, Jesus himself, 600 years later, repeatedly used the image of fire or the image of a furnace for the final judgment of God. He said, for example, in Matthew 13, the Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the blazing furnace. And the gospel is that rescue from the furnace of God's judgment is to be found not because the judgment is not carried out, but because Jesus himself endures judgment so that we are shielded from it. That's what we're seeing when we look at Jesus on the cross. And Christian people live daily in the light of that. It's because we know that he has endured judgment, the depth of Jesus' love and commitment to us, that he has endured the furnace so that we might be shielded, because we know the certainty of his coming kingdom because of his resurrection, that we say to ourselves, even before we say it to our world, God may deliver me, he may grant my desires, but even if he does not, I will not bow. Is that true of you this week? I will not bow. I will not change the gospel. I will not abandon prayer. I will not stop loving my neighbor. I will not stop living for his kingdom. So may it be of us. Amen.